Okay, right. So my name is Evan Scannapieco, and I'm a postdoc here at the ITP, and mostly I work on galaxy formation and structure formation and cosmological evolution. But despite these shortcomings of mine, Ken nevertheless gave me 15 minutes to tell you a little bit about some work I did with Lars Bilston on trying to relate to the type 1a supernova rate, so discussing issues very closely related to what Enrico was just talking about. So the main motivation for our work was sort of two things. One is this well-known correlation between the brightest 1As and the peak magnitudes of 1As in their environment. It's easier to measure this decay time. So if you just plot up the galaxy types associated with 1As with different decay times, you find that the brightest ones are in these irregular and disky star-forming galaxies, where if you look for the BG types, the very short decay times, they're all in galaxies with very old stellar populations, so ellipticals and S0s. Okay, so we see this dichotomy in environments. And the second motivation for this paper we wrote was these very nice observational paper by Minucci et al. That Enrico discussed. And what they did was they combined that sample of that historical sample of supernovae with K-band magnitudes of galaxies taken from the two-mass survey. And as you know, K-band is very nice because it's not heavily affected by dust or age or metallicity or like that, so it allows for this normalization. And this is a plot he showed before, giving the rate of supernovae per 10 to the 10 solar masses per century for these different types. And this is for galaxies of different colors, with the bluest ones being over here on the left, going down to the red ones over here. And what you see is that for the blue ones, there's this strong correlation between the core collapse rate and the 1A rate. And then there's this excess here in the ellipticals where you don't see core collapse supernovae, but you still see 1As. Okay, so core collapse, okay, they're coming from massive stars, so they ought to trace the star formation rate. So what this right away suggested to us is a model where 1As have two pieces, one that traces the star formation rate very closely, but then another extra piece with a very long time scale. So we'll just take that to be proportional to stellar mass, okay? An extra piece. So we tried to look at a rate that looks something like this. Some number times the star formation rate and some other number times the total mass that you have in stars, okay? You can then calibrate these two numbers pretty easily. There's two ways to calibrate this one. The first one is to use the colors that I just showed you to estimate the star formation rates in these galaxies. Or you can work indirectly, and you can use that correlation between the core collapse rate and the 1A rate, and then relate the core collapse to star formation rate to get you this number. Okay, and those numbers give you consistent normalizations. This number here is pretty much just set by the elliptical galaxies and the ellipticals and S0s. Okay. And once you do that, you can then apply this model to, say, an example galaxy. Here I've taken a sort of a fiducial galaxy in which I'm allowing stars to form at a rate that's equal to the mass remaining in gas. So I just take a big cloud of gas, and I say that the rate of star formation is just that gas mass over tau. So it's exponentially making stars. With a time scale, I've just taken to be 2 gigayears here. So it's just an example. And then you can ask, what are the rates of different supernovae in such a galaxy? Okay, well, here's the core collapse rate. So this is a log scale, right? So it's just dropping linearly in a log scale because it's exponential. And here is the 1A rate divided up into two components. One is this prompt component here, and the second one is this delayed component here. And what you see is that for most of this galaxy's history, until the star formation rate is pretty low, so about a tenth of the average rate, it's dominated by this prompt component, okay? But then you have this other component that's coming up late in, at very late times. You can do an integral of both these things, and what you find is that the prompt component always dominates. So most 1As in the universe are coming from this piece that pretty much tracks star formation rate. And that's how I got into this first, because it has important implications for cosmological enrichment. So here I show a plot of, so these are points of the average iron content of clusters observed at different redshifts, okay? going out to about redshift 1.2. And this relates to this, there's this well-known problem in cluster enrichment. And that's appeared in a lot of papers, and most notably papers by Alveo and Renzini. And it goes like this. You look at clusters, and you say, okay, I think most of the iron in a cluster is coming from 1As, okay, because core collapse are not thought to be good producers of iron. We could argue about that. But if you take just the 1A, right, then you say, okay, well, what is the rate that of 1As that I see in a cluster? Okay, so you go and find that. You multiply by Hubble time, and you get some value for the amount of iron that you should expect. Okay, it's very low. Okay, it's about a factor of 10 lower than what's observed. Not only that, since if you go to earlier times, that ought to be dropping, okay, because you have a rate that you're multiplying by a Hubble time. Hubble time at redshift 1 is a lot less, so that number's lower, so it should be dropping like this. But in a model that's dominated by this prompt component, instead, you're getting most of your iron when you put the cluster together, when you first make the stars. And then the amount of iron that you add later is kind of small compared to that. So you expect this number to be much higher. So this is what we predict. And then it goes up a tiny bit, but really not all that much. This cyan region is the 1 sigma error bars. Okay, then you can also use it to predict, well, you can combine it with the observed star formation rate density in the universe, and you can try to predict how it's going with redshift. So this is a plot, this is this Dalen plot that you just saw. This is some local points here, these open triangles, and these Dalen points are the solid ones. Now, we're dominated by the prompt component, right? So we're closely tracing the star formation almost over the whole history here. Right? And it's not dropping at redshift 1.5. So there's no way to reproduce this point with a model like this. So let me just emphasize that any model where most of the 1As are tracking star formation will never reproduce that point. Okay? There has to be something else in there. But this point could easily move up. After all, it's only one supernovae.
That's not a measurement. If you have one measurement, it means nothing.
Right, but we didn't give that point too much weight.
Would expect to have 10 times our depth, so it's a measurement, Because to get to the point I is a logarithmic scale, you need to.
But the error on the measurement, you always get by dividing by. No, the error rate. Minus one.
Let's say it's
n
like
minus one is zero. So you divide by zero.
It's like saying that it's
an error of this.
Yeah, it's like saying that it's an error of limits.
Well, okay, I'm not a big fan of that point either. Let me just say the mix at low redshift between the prompt and the star-forming components. We get them about equal, say, so we expect sort of half of the 1As at redshift zero to be coming from old population and half coming from new. But there's a big error bar there. And if you go even up a little bit in redshift, it's mostly dominated by prompt. So I think that's more consistent with what you're saying. Let me just say something about the star formation. Right, I just added this plot right now. Here's the original one from Madow. Okay, so going up and down. And then, so dropping right above redshift 1. That would work to fit Dalen. But after a while, people figure out that there were strong dust corrections to these points. So here's a paper by Steidel in 99. It goes up and down, and then more recent. I mean, when you correct it for dust, it's flat. And then more recent measurements are all consistent with this. So basically, all the rates I'm using are going up steeply to about 1, and then pretty much flat after that. I think everybody agrees on that now. So just to give you the history of that, and to point out that people are pretty. This is getting pretty good now.
So we have a question: when you were showing plots per day, the volume plot, the star formation rate, the volume, or the star formation rate?
But which volume?
Okay, I just want to make sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
You convert the rate per unit luminosity, the rate per unit volume, knowing the luminosity density.
Yeah. So I couldn't resist putting this. So that's the only measurement that there is at 1.5 or 1.3 or whatever it is, that one supernovae. But there's this recent paper by Barris and Tonry where they talk a lot about a better sample at lower redshifts. And in this case, they find, comparing that to the star formation rate, they find that they can't allow for a long delay like Dalen et al. Wants. In fact, okay, I don't know them personally, but nevertheless, they said, oh, look, ours fits just nicely and delay doesn't. So I think there's something to at least having this prompt component that's tracking star formation very closely. So how is our model different from what other people did? So typically, what fits that have been done in those many papers that Enrico pointed out is you want to know the 1A rate, and so you take it to be the star formation rate convolved with some function that you don't know. Okay, that's pretty general. It's probably right. But then the next step is to say, well, this function has a single time, it has a single delay time that we don't know, but we're going to fit. Here are three popular ways to parameterize this function. One is just to take it to be an exponential proportional to time here with the delay time that you don't know. So this is what you're fitting here. Or a Gaussian that's shifted over by that time, and maybe with various width. So for each of these functions, you have two unknowns. You have a normalization, and you have a time constant, right? So we tried to fit them to the Minucci at all points, just picking the bluest one and the very reddest one. Okay, so we have two points, two unknowns. We fit each of them. The blue curves are the ones I showed you before, and the red curves are what you get for this sort of example galaxy for different ages here. And what you find is that these intermediate ages, these things kind of peak and they give you very, very high 1A rates. So you get really very, very funny fits that don't look right at all, rates that are very high here and nothing like what's observed. So I think it's very hard to fit this data with a single time scale. That's just an important point to make. So finally, I just want to say something about halo stars. We do know that there are alpha-enriched things in the universe. So in particular, if you look at the galactic halo, say, a lot of the low-metallicity stars have oxygen over iron that's much higher than solar. So if you just said 1As are forming contemporaneously with core collapse supernova, you'd never get anything like that. So they can't be a zero delay. But it doesn't have to be a long one. It's dependent on how long you think it takes this halo to assemble. Here I've taken a one-zone model with a time scale of 2 gigayears for star formation. And there you need a short delay of about half a gigayear, and you get the right alpha enrichment. If you think the halo formed faster than that, well, then you bring this time down. Or if it's longer, it goes up. Okay, but you do need a short delay in that prompt component. Okay, so that's all I had to say. So just to summarize, I think it's pretty clear that a single component model is not going to fit the local data. And you can do that using even the 1A rate normalized by the K-band, if you prefer, instead of using the mass as I did. But a two-component model does pretty well, and it's motivated by, it also is consistent with seeing different peak magnitudes in different environments. It also fixes this problem with cluster iron enrichment that's been hanging around for a really long time. So I think that's another thing in its favor. However, we're really only going to know when we get better measurements out here at higher redshift. And finally, I'd say this makes observations that constrain the 1A rate on very small timescales. So for example, there are old papers on correlating with spiral arms and this sort of thing. And improving these sorts of measurements would really might become interesting again now that it looks like this component, there's this prompt component of 1As. Okay, so that's all I have.
Could you reproduce the observed rates if, instead of having a two-component model, having initial mass functions that differ for different galaxies?
Initial mass function. Well,
because you're only looking at...
I mean, all you have to do is get sort of two... Right. Right.
So perhaps in some galaxies, so that traces core collapse rate, but it may not necessarily trace the production of lower mass stars.
I don't know. Well, you need to get. Well, you need to make these ones. So how would you make these ones? By moving the IMF around?
No.
You need to have 1As in galaxies with no core collapse, right?
Would it work the same if you, I don't know for which mechanism, you just turn on a prompt mechanism, say 5 billion years from the Big Bang? Or, at some point, you turn on the prompt mechanism. Wouldn't it be the same?
I see. Well, yes. So, okay, I guess that was your point when we were talking about these. Yes, you could take, let's say, one, about the only way you could think to reconcile the Dahlen measurement with this sort of a thing is if you have this long time scale for a long time, but then it's, as you suggest, you have the prompt channel that you're only turning on after some amount of time. Okay, then you could fit this data because you'd have these two components at low redshift, but you could still have a drop at high redshift because you have this switch that you're throwing. I guess you were saying yesterday maybe metallicity might be one possible way to do that. So, but I don't know. I mean, but then again, you know, I don't know that the metallicity is going to be that different at redshift, you know, 1.5.
Mm-hmm.
If it was 5, it would be something else, but 1.5, no.
Several comments.
Yes.
First, I think your results agree exactly with what we get as well.
So okay.
There's no discrepancy.
Okay, good.
But
it's a bit worried after you, last week.
Yes. Certainly, some, for example, the time delay functions people are assuming really don't make much sense because, I mean, that's not what the theoretical models predict. They don't ever predict exponentials or Gaussians. Now, the narrow Gaussian can be similar to what the single agent model predicts, but the others are just different. So it's not surprising that these time delay functions give you discrepancies.
Yeah. Well, I think it's very, well, but I kind of have a feeling it's a little bit stronger than that, in that any theoretical model that just has sort of one time scale in it is going to have a problem.
I agree with that too. I mean, I agree that you need some long time
delay. Did it just get stuck?
Yes. Yeah. It's both for your talk and for previous talk that you showed second quote, the 5.8 rising square root. I'm just wondering why special Lars Bilson didn't notice. He worked on multi-competency binary problems in global clusters. Global clusters are also do also produce all the time 5.8 supernova. And global clusters they are associated with ellipticals. And this is your mechanism to produce it steadily. You don't need some special delay function or whatever. This is exactly your plateau. So why Lars didn't...
So you're saying...
But you assume that type 1A supernovae come from W generals, which Lars probably doesn't.
Why? No. It's not necessarily double degenerates.
Well, the supersoft model doesn't give you type 1As in old global clusters.
No one ever seen a type 1A in a global cluster, by the way.
Yeah.
You mean, okay.
I don't think it's ever been discovered as well.
So you're saying binaries that are...
The statistic is not good enough because the...
Yeah, okay, I don't know. I mean, yeah, sure. So that, so for example, you could say most of them trace star formation, except for sometimes you have binaries that form in globulars, and that's another component. For example, that would give you two time scales. I don't know. Ken, you also wrote a paper that has two channels.
Yeah.
Maybe you could comment on that. I don't know. No? Or maybe you're not so sure about that paper anyway.
Well, star dependencies, since I haven't followed this at all, but it sounds like fell up here. Have you done models? Do you know what the time dependencies do? What do they look? I mean, I understand why I wouldn't expect an exponential decay or certainly the Gaussians either.
Well, in a supersoft scenario, for example, you get a distribution that's actually consistent with something else you said. It gives a mean time delay of about half a gigayear.
Oh, really?
But after
we have to make a white dwarf.
Years, it's completely over. So they cannot give you the long time delays. And in the W-generated merger, you get also type 1A supernova very quickly after 30 or 50 million years, and most of them also occur within a giga year, but then afterwards you get a power law tail, and you can even calculate what that exponent is because it just depends on gravitational radiation, so it's very well defined.
Yeah, so that sort of thing
so
would also
two,
work.
These are two of the main models, and then of course you can do it for the other models.
Yeah.
And for the red giant channel, which I think one probably needs, when we model this, the binary population synthesis, we have problems of producing them. But that may be our problem, not and the progenitor, Ken has calculated the properties you need for in the period and mass distribution, mass diagram, and we can
binary,
we can try to populate them, but we don't populate them enough.
I mean, physically,
a global cluster, that might be differentiable, that's right.
Yeah. So maybe. Oh, so so the coincidence of 1As and globular clusters might be interesting to look at as well.
No, I have never been found one, but we sometimes work it out.
But how often can you even see them?
The statistic is not good enough.
Yeah.
No. And locally, because then, it must be in the galaxy. Since in the galaxy we are not seeing one supernova in the last 400 years, there is no much chance to serve anywhere. Yeah, for nearby galaxies, never be observed, but that can be a problem of observations. Or
so there are several optical galaxies where like tons of global clusters are identified now, but it was no supernova in those galaxies.
Well, no one was associated with a global cluster, for sure, but I cannot exclude, because then you have a problem of projection, you know, because how you know that this is a global cluster? You have no way to read it. Put it inside.
Yeah,
but also Elliot said that those type 1 waves which are associated with elliptical galaxies where they're less bright, right? But it's just a bit different.
Yes.
So that is perfectly cool fine to cool come from different channel. I mean, there is nothing wrong with
that. Right, it's fine. Yeah. I mean, they look different photometrically.
I mean, I think it's true that the faint ones, the 91 BG likes, tend to be in the ellipticals.
Yes.
No evidence of star formation.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to.
I don't know.
No evidence for recent star formation. Not active anyway, but not in the last gigajoule.
So. I don't know. I mean, well, I don't know. Do you believe this point?
Sure.
I mean, because this point, it's pretty hard to explain away with star formation. And, you know, take this rate and try to play with star formation, you can't get that.
The data are there, As usual, I think that the kite data can
we'll get this better.
Yes. Okay. Yes, because the sample is 3 times larger and
It'll be interesting to see how these things get better measured.
One BC in Earth,
or known if you really say known. Because there are some cases sometimes it's classified elliptica in the catalog. It's dangerous things because you let the supernova type 1A, the catalog say elliptical, you don't care.
Yeah.
Because the 1BC, a catalog say elliptical, you look to the galaxy and say, no, it's not elliptical. You know? So I don't like this approach of looking to a single event because.
And even ellipticals sometimes have star formation a little bit. You know.
Yeah, there is.
So.
Yeah, actually, we observed it last December, 1BC, 1B.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like one.
Okay.
No question? Okay,
thank
you.
Okay.